This is the Saturday Supplement. I'm Frank Lewis. Today, a trip we were to take a year ago to Orkney Island, where Siobhan and I honeymooned 51 years ago. It is 10 miles, 16 kilometres north of the Scottish mainland. In 1975, on bicycle, staying in a B&B. It was a time when there was great enthusiasm and some foreboding about oil. Particular memories, Scarab Ray, Stones of Stiness, the Ring of Bradgar, Maes Howe. Hugely interesting half a century ago. Now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Our experience is just of the island of Mainland. There are 70 islands altogether, 20 inhabited. 22,000 people live here on the Orkney Islands, 18,000 of these on Mainland, a ninth of the size of Kerry. Yesterday, 5 hours walking along a clifftop from Yesnaby to Scarab Ray, great numbers of seabirds, oyster catchers yelping, fulmars swooping and rising, yells and ravens looking for an opportunity, terns screaming and dive bombing, ready access to coast everywhere, carpets of sea pink and the tiny purpley blue spring squill, fertile land, fields full of sheep and cows, friendly people. Today's programme was recorded on June the 1st and the 3rd. For later programmes, your comments and stories, write Frank Lewis, Mangerton Road, Muckross, Killarney. Email franklewismangerton@gmail.com. Text 083 300 3300 or phone 066 712 3666. Our Orkney mentor, who handheld us, showed the way, had an expert input in every conversation. Tom Muir, an Orcadian storyteller, historian and author, worked for 37 years in Orkney Museum. With his wife Rhonda, have set up Orkneyology.com, a publishing company that aims to share Orkney's hidden delights. And by the way, I asked our innkeeper to get a place, sheltered place by the sea where we could pick up bird sound in the background. And she advised here, where we're inland, beside a number of small ponds, and you're hearing the birds of the inland. Now a place that all those years ago made such an impression on us, the Italian Chapel, as well as our guide to Orkney, Tom Muir. We're joined by John Muir, a long-term member of the Italian Chapel Preservation Committee. 1,550 Italian prisoners of war captured in North Africa were brought here to work on the Churchill barriers, joining four causeways to block German sea access to Scapa Flow. Tom, contrast weather conditions in North Africa.
Well, it would have been a bit of a culture shock for them. Well, not just culture shock, but weather shock for them, because obviously they're in being held in camps in Egypt, and then some were sent to India to POW camps there, but then some were sent to Britain, and then ultimately these about 1,000 or so were sent to Orkney to work on the barriers. And they arrived in either January, February. There seems to be a bit of a confusion as to which month they actually arrived. But midwinter, just at the bleakest, darkest time of the year. And they must have just thought that they were being cast into one of, you know, Dante's pits.
John, who built the chapel and why?
Well, the man who gives the credit for the painting of the chapel was a man by the name of Domenico Chiacchetti. At the time, he lived in Moena, which is up in the north of Italy, among the mountains, a very beautiful little village. And
he was one of the prisoners of war sent here.
He was one of the prisoners of war who approached the British camp commandant and asked if they could be provided with a Nissen hut that they could make into a chapel that they could use for services.
So, and we're in the Nissen hut, we're in front of the altar. A lot of the prisoners must have been involved.
Men with different skills, stonemasons, the wrought iron work was done by a blacksmith. It was the fact that the British camp commandant had been to Italy before the war. Yeah. He had a love of Italy, and the men benefited greatly from the fact that he could speak some Italian.
And the lamps here have an interesting beginning.
These two here were made from bully beef tins. So they were very, very clever with their hands. They could make things from nothing, you know. The Nissen hut was lined with plasterboard and fibreboard. And the painting above the altar, as Tom said, it was done from a prayer card.
So it was a prayer card that one of the prisoners had brought with him from Italy.
Dominica's mother gave him this little prayer card that he kept in his pocket all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a copy of a very famous painting by Barabino, which is still in existence in Italy. Mm-hmm. And he used that prayer card as the basis for his Madonna and Child painting.
Beautiful.
And Domenico himself was a very quiet, very peaceful man. Mm-hmm. And he is incorporated into the painting many aspects of peace. You can see the Christ Child is holding the olive tree. Uh-huh. The cherub on the right-hand side here is putting its sheath back into its scabbard. And the cherub on the left-hand side is holding the coat of arms of Moena. Mm-hmm.
And you have a whole range of angels there as well.
Yeah, and the Dove of Peace on the ceiling, of course. And that, I've been to a church in Moena many times, and that Dove of Peace is very high up on the ceiling in the church in Moena. So he had that in his mind when he was doing this.
Indeed. Tom, I mean, previously the island was uninhabited. Where were the Italians billeted or housed?
Well, there was Nizan huts all the way around here as well.
John, the man particularly responsible for the chapel, as you said, Domenico Cerchetti, he stayed on after the war to complete the work on the chapel here.
He delayed his departure for about 1 month. But immediately after the war, the chapel was completely neglected. In fact, it was almost demolished with the rest of the camp. But the foreman of the demolition squad came to this and he said, there's no way I'm knocking this building down. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would have been flattened with the rest of the building. Right. It was just touch and go.
And he came back later on. He came back in the 60s to take part in the restoration.
Yes, after the war, as I said, was neglected. The door was off its hinges. The sheep was going out and in. It was almost at the end of its existence.
When did they first begin to restore it?
Well, the daughter of the man who owned the island at the time, Alison Graham, she took it upon herself to form a little committee. Mm-hmm. They called themselves the Preservation Committee. That was in 1958. And they set about, through the BBC and the broadcasting people in Italy, they put out a programme asking if anyone knew of a man called Domenico Cerchetti and would he get in touch. A friend heard the programme, contacted him, and through that they brought him back for the first time, and he spent quite some time here in Orkney doing restoration work, and that was the first restoration. The restoration work has gone on since.
Mm. So when did the church reopen then?
Well, it was never closed. It just kept for a long time. When it was run by a charity, the door was, it was just locked at night and opened in the morning. And that went on until about 10 years ago. Mm. Some idiot came in here and stripped three of the Stations of the Cross off the wall and stole them.
Gosh, did you get them back?
Never got them back, but they got tremendous publicity, radio, press. Mm. So the guy, he probably thought he could sell them, but, you know, there was no way he could do anything with them. But I actually took one off the wall, sent it to the daughter in Moena, and she got the carver to do replicas. So they're now replicas. You would never know they're replicas. Right. And they're now securely fixed on the wall. Mm. A friend of mine came along and he took a very strong solution called elephant shit, which now means that
they can't be moved.
It can't be removed.
It's a place, Tom, of all sorts of stories, as you were saying earlier.
There was a story that Giuseppe Palumbi, who did the wrought iron work, fell in love with a local woman, and which was a slight problem because he was married with a son back in Naples. But he told her when he left, I've left something for you in the centre of the chapel. And as you can see, there's the gates here at the rood screen. Mm. And on the floor, the little stop there to stop the gates from swinging in is a heart. Uh-huh. And that is what he left. He left his heart.
It must have been more than a sort of fleeting, passing friendship, because he named his daughter Barbara. His granddaughter is Barbara, mm-hmm. and that was the name of his Orkney girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And Barbara and her husband have actually been here to see the chapel.
Mass is still celebrated in this unique chapel.
Yes, they have Mass here on the first Sunday of each month and during the summer months. Mm-hmm. And there are many weddings here, and any denomination can get married here. We now have a lady from Rome who comes over to do restoration work. The first time that she came to speak to me, and I said to her, what have you been doing in the last 6 months? And she said, well, I've been working for 2 years in the Sistine Chapel. Oh. So I thought it was maybe take a risk on her.
Fantastic. John Muir, thanks indeed for talking to us.
Pleasure.
Thanks indeed.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
On our return to Orkney after 51 years, guided by author, historian and storyteller Tom Muir, Siobhan and I honeymooned here in 1975. Orkney, as I've said earlier, is 15 kilometres off the north coast of Scotland. We're now at the Ring of Brodgar. In the Ness of Brodgar is underneath us, considered the most significant discovery. This 2.5 hectare, 6 acre complex is between the Ring of Brodgar and Stinnes Stones. And here we're joined by Historic Environment Scotland ranger Sandra Miller. Sandra, what has been found here has been described as monumental architecture.
The Ness of Brodgar site is absolutely remarkable, and it's changed how we think about Neolithic life, not just here in Orkney, but across the rest of the country. And we've seen a very exciting 20 past years looking at that.
So what has changed? What is as a result of that?
So for us here at the Ring of Brodgar, our perception of the site has changed. We used to think that we were the most important kid on the block here, but now it turns out we're maybe just the poor next door neighbours.
Yeah, so that what's underneath you there is the real richness.
Absolutely. So what we've got down the road between us and the Stones of Stennis is a complex of very large buildings from the Neolithic period, the likes of which we have never seen before. They're 3, 4, 5 times the size of the buildings you will have seen at Scarabree, for example. Mm-hmm. It's described variously as a site of pilgrimage, a sort of ceremonial complex. Perhaps it was a place that people came to maybe build and use the stone circles either side. In truth, we don't know, because of course, when we deal with this period in history, we are very much like detectives. We look at the evidence that's been left behind and we try and make some kind of sense of it.
So what is there?
So at the moment, it is completely covered over, and we have only excavated about 10% of the site there. But the guys down the road have done a remarkable job in kind of piecing things together. They think up to about 100 different buildings, almost like a Middle Eastern tell site where you've got building on building on building on building. And they literally have just scratched the surface.
So there's a huge amount of further work to be done there.
Huge amount of further work for somebody to do someday.
And I mean, clearly this was a centre of innovation.
Absolutely. I mean, I like to think of this kind of area here as the city centre of Orkney. You know, 5,000 years ago, there's a huge amount of activity going on here, you know, building and reusing buildings, changing things, moving stones around. So this would have been a hive of activity. Mm.
So instead of being at the periphery of the near island to you, you're very much the centre of the world.
Well, let's face it, we always knew Orkney was the centre of the universe, whether it's 5,000 years ago or today.
Nothing has changed.
Nothing's changed as far as I'm concerned.
Tom, the abundance of finds, over 1,000 pieces of Neolithic art, more than the rest of the United Kingdom combined. Mm-hmm. I mean, decorated pottery and stone mace heads, mm-hmm. indicating obviously a significant ceremonial centre used between 3,300 and 2,300 BC.
Well, the thing that's remarkable about Ness of Brodgar is we always thought that everybody had, you know, in the Neolithic, everybody had thatched roofs. And fortunately, the archaeologist in charge of it, Nick Card, also was a builder in the past, and he recognised all these thin sheets of stone lying over the middle of buildings was actually a slate roof that had collapsed. Now, we had no concept of the idea that, you know, they had slate roofs, but they did. And also pigment use as well, grinding up minerals to give different colours. Yeah. And we found painted pottery, and they also found painted decoration on the walls as well, on some of the stones. Mm. So suddenly, somebody once said, it took the Neolithic out of the monochrome and into technicolour. You know?
Sandra, I mean, as you were suggesting earlier, there's ongoing discovery here. I mean, after the main excavation ended in 2024, the groundbreaking 3D radar surveys in 2025 mm-hmm. discovered more again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are very much looking forward to the excavation again now in July this year to see what the team will uncover down there.
I mean, as you were suggesting earlier, some of the structures that you've come across there are huge.
Mm-hmm. Huge, yeah. These are buildings that are more than just a pile of stones to keep the rain off, you know. Yeah. These, as Tom says, are absolutely monumental.
Yeah. I mean, a large stone wall made 100 metres, 330 feet long and 13 feet or more wide. I mean, it's an immense...
It's an immense construction, and as we see here at the Ring of Brodgar too, you know, these people are not afraid of, you know, big, ambitious projects, you know.
The Ring of Brodgar were giants who used to like to gather together and dance to the sound of a fiddle playing.
Of course.
And one night they were dancing around in a great circle, and they were enjoying themselves so much that they lost track of time, and the sun rose and they were turned to stone. And there they remain as the Ring of Brodgar. And the comet stone that stands next to it was the fiddle player.
Fantastic.
But I mean, people used to be scared of going by here in the at night, after kind of sundown, because of the number of mounds around here. Because I mean, all these mounds, well, this huge one, Salt Now, may have been the debris from the dig in the ditch around the stones, the Ring of Brodgar. But then the other mounds that you see are all sort of Bronze Age date and have kist burials in them. So it was seen as being an important place where people were reusing. But then people thought that this was the home of the Trolls, the fairy folk in Orkney. And so, you know, they were scared about going past there until they could cross the bridge, which meant they'd passed running water and were safe.
Fantastic singing there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the whap showing me up.
I think one of the lovely things about the Ring of Brodgar is, as Tom says, you can approach it on so many different levels. You know, you've got the archaeological aspect, the kind of importance of it as an iconic site for Orkney, but also the folklore angle as well. I always remember kind of early on in my career here at Brodgar, one Orkney mum here with a lot of kids, and she said to them, you know, these are giants, you know, just be quiet, stop running around. In fact, if you listen to the stones, you can hear them move. So that's one way of keeping your kids calm, is getting them to listen to the stones to see if they'll try and move and get home.
There was once I was given a talk in Sandwick, and I was driving back here. It was in the middle of winter. It was an absolutely beautiful night. There was a lot of snow on the ground, which is getting to be unusual here these days. And there was a full moon, and the whole place was just shining, you know. So I decided to stop and just go for a walk around the stones. And the only thing that surprised me was that I didn't see a trow coming out from behind the stones. But the thing is, I could hear the sound of voices in the distance, yeah, which maybe suggests this is why they chose that spot.
Describe the Ring of Brodgar, if you would, for me, Sandra.
Yeah, no problem. Well, as Tom says, it's a circle of standing stones, about 104 metres in diameter, and sits within this beautiful natural amphitheatre. You know, we were talking about a wide open space, but we can see, you know, the houses over towards Yesnaby, we can see up to Bursey, we can see across the Orford Hills, and if we can see them, they can see us. So for the Neolithic people, it maybe was all about drawing you into this central area.
But is there anything as big as this? I mean, the number of standing stones here.
So we have larger stone circles in Britain, Avebury, for example, in a place called Stantondrew, but this is about the third largest stone circle.
But how many stones?
Well, it depends how many you count, and there's one of the great mysteries abroad, Garrett. Some folks say, you know, we've got 21 stones standing, we've got 10 stumps, but also some of our stones have been re-erected in the past as well. So they say there's space for anything between 60 and 70 stones, and there's just over half of that that remain.
And then, I mean, a huge ditch.
Ditch around the outside. It's a remarkable ditch. And, you know, I was just thinking about Tom saying there about this, in the moonlight, how the stones shone bright. But the ditch around the ring is a rock-cut ditch. Mm. And it, on a moonlight night, that too would have been quite noticeable.
Yeah.
You know, the ditch goes down. Today you only see about half the ditch. The ditch originally goes down about 4 metres deep. And at its widest, it's about 10 metres across. It really is a substantial piece of construction. And that's even before we talk about moving stones.
Absolutely.
We think it would have taken about 300 people a whole summer to dig out that ditch.
Yeah.
The kind of thinking about the ring is not about the end product, it's about the moving of the stones.
Mm. Mm.
And, you know, the moving of the stones isn't something that you enter into lightly. You've got to plan and prepare and rope and, you know, source your stone, move your stone, and then get it here. Getting it here's the last bit.
The stones that make up the ring are not actually from the same place. They're from different locations all over the islands. And some of them, like there was one of them that came from Houghton, which is on the other side of the hill over there. So you're looking at miles away and not a particularly easy move.
Sandra, fantastic. We're going to have you again at the Stones of Stenness, and Tom is guiding me on to another place, so we'll talk to you from there in a few minutes.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney. Serving the finest seafood in a cosy modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
Siobhan and I are back in Orkney 51 years after we spent our honeymoon here in 1975. We're now looking down.
Well, the island is called Lamb's Home. It's one of the small islands they joined up together with the Churchill barriers to stop U-boats coming through.
And we're looking down on Scapa Flow, a sheltered body of water spanning approximately 312 square kilometres in the Orkney Islands of northern Scotland. Surrounded by Orkney Islands, it's one of the largest natural harbours in the world. It's globally renowned for its strategic role in the primary base for the British Royal Navy during World War One and Two. We're joined by Angus Constam, author of more than 100 books on maritime history, and piracy is a specialty. On the 21st of June 1919, here in Scapa Flow, after the fighting of World War One had ended and peace negotiations were underway, why did the German Admiral Ludwig von Reuter order the scuttling by his own sailors of the Imperial German Navy's high seas fleet of 74 German ships?
Well, of course, the Germans had signed the armistice in November 1918, and negotiations for the Treaty of Versailles were still underway. But things were reaching ahead by the following June. And all that time, the German ships had been stuck here with a skeleton crew who were bored, rigid. Everyone else had gone home. The war was over. Everyone had been reunited with their families, but not the sailors and the ships, and the people guarding them. And it became a real issue as well for German pride, because essentially part of the deal was when that was signed, they had to hand over the fleet to the victorious Allies and it would be split up. So von Reuter, who was in charge of it, was a fairly honourable man and he didn't really want that to happen. He saw it as a stain on Germany's honour. So he would sooner scuttle the fleet than let it fall into enemy hands.
The Royal Navy were away at exercises on that day and had to come rushing back, and then they did manage to get a few ashore. So there was about 50 ships that sank.
There was a fear that in the event of a treaty that was bad for Germany, some sailors might mutiny.
Well, at the end of the war, Germany was in a state of revolt. There was revolution. Everyone had been starving. My own father was in Germany at the time. I've a German father and a Scottish mother, hence the strange surname. And he'd been collecting grass from the verges to feed to the German horses on the Western Front at the end of the war. So, you know, they were in a bad way, and starvation was rampant. So there was that. There was incredible discontent. And with the abdication of the Kaiser, the whole system of government was falling apart. So this was the backdrop in Germany. A lot of the sailors wanted to get home to be with their families. And there was also mutiny within the Navy.
During the 7 or 8 months of internment, what was life like on board the German ships?
Horrendous. I mean, the big problem that they had was rats. Huge quantities of rats. They were being fed from Germany. The British government took no responsibility. So there was water was supplied from Stromness, but the food had to come from Germany. And so you can imagine that the rations were fairly meagre. But as Angus said earlier, boredom was the biggest problem.
Indescribable filth on some. I mean, proposed orders were considered and countersigned by the men's committee and then carried out as convenient.
Von Reuter was in a small light cruiser rather than when he first came across. He was in the Friedrich der Große, one of the largest battleships. The crew were so mutinous that they made his life hell. And they actually had a scheme where they would roller skate on the deck directly above his cabin. And they had it in sort of like relays and shifts that you were on roller skating duty just to annoy von Reuter.
It does, though, Angus, doesn't it sound amazing that these were effectively prisoners of war? I mean, they were held here in internment, and yet this huge scuttling was able to take place.
It was one of the best-kept secrets of the war, really. The British were essentially taken by surprise. As Tom said, the Grand Fleet had gone out on exercise, thinking everything was well. And as Tom will no doubt recall, there was even a group of children from Stromness, about 400 kids, on a boat called the Flying Kestrel, touring round in the, between the lines of all these German ships, and all of a sudden they started go low in the water or start going on to funny angles, and then that's when panic ensued, not just with the kids, also with the captain of the thing, because ships going down around you makes the water pretty turbulent in a midsummer sort of day. But above all, it was the Navy were not really best pleased, the British Navy.
There wasn't any great loss of life.
Well, the official record is that there was 9.
But sunk ships were left at the bottom of Scapa Flow after complaints by locals that the wrecks were a hazard to the navigation. A salvage company was set up.
The divers were there welding the hulls to block any holes in the hulls so they could pump them full of air and bring them to the surface. It was a major technological achievement, and it really transformed the whole world of marine salvage at the same time.
I mean, that entrepreneur Ernest Cox bought 26 destroyers for £250, equivalent to 15,000, I'm told now. They lifted 24 of the 26 destroyers and patched holes in submarine hulls, as you say, and pumped them. But he made quite a bit of money out of it.
He did. But it also, it cost a fortune too. And it was still going on right through the interwar period. And Tom's got, will know a lot about the way the Arcadians were involved in this too.
Tom?
Well, I mean, it actually cushioned Orkney during the Depression. So it brought employment to local people. They were all working on the salvaging.
Scapa Flow knew another major. I mean, the sinking of the Royal Oak in 1939 was one of the biggest single disasters in British military history.
We're standing on the island that overlooks the very channel that Gunther Preen sailed through on the night of on the 13th and 14th of October 1939. And the war had only been going for a few weeks by the time Gunther Preen came in. So he just had to slip around the existing First World War block ships. He went through on the surface and because it's too shallow otherwise. He scraped against the bottom once, he scraped against an anchor cable, but got through. And the British weren't really effectively guarding it. And again, most of the fleet was out. So he went to the main fleet anchorage, found it was pretty much empty, and then he headed north and he found the HMS Royal Oak. It had a crew of over 800 men on board.
So of the 834 lost here, only 24 bodies were recovered. Their ship was declared a war grave.
It's an open wound, or it was certainly in Orkney, because I remember my mother, who was, you know, remembered very well, she was born in 1922, saying that they were just bairns on that ship, they were just boys. Because they had left boy sailors on board that ship because the other ones were going into, you know, battle zones. And so these boys were aged between 15 and 18, and there's about 163 of them was on board.
It was hit by a torpedo at the bow, and people thought it was a paint store exploding or something, and they went back to sleep. There was a panic. Gunther Preen in U-47 had fired his torpedoes. Then he had time to potter around in Scapa Flow and reload and fire again. And it was the last torpedoes that hit it, and they caused started a fireball that went through the ship.
There is a green light working on the buoy, marking the spot, still lighting.
Yeah, there's a buoy over the side that says that it is a war grave.
You just had a new book launched.
It's about the Norse Earls of Orkney. When Orkney was the sort of centre of the expansion of from Scandinavia, especially Norway, into Britain and Ireland, and raiding and then settling. And the Earldom of Orkney for 500 years sort of was the sort of central hub of all that.
Very interesting. Thanks indeed for talking to us, Angus.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963.
In our return to Orkney, 16 kilometres off the north coast of Scotland, 51 years after Siobhan and I honeymooned here in 1975, we cycled here to the Stones of Stenness, one of the finest stone circles in Britain. And we're joined by Sandra Miller, who is a ranger, as I told you a few minutes ago. Sandra, describe where we are.
Right, so we're standing here at the Standing Stones of Stenness, which are part of the Heart of Neolithic Orkney World Heritage Site. We're about a mile down the road from the Ring of Brodgar, and straight across the field in that direction we can see the tomb at Maeshowe.
Mm-hmm. And there are how many standing stones here altogether?
I think we have four standing and a few sockets. Clearly these things are meant to be seen.
The stones here are much bigger.
These are much taller. In fact, I often liken these to very elegant ladies at a cocktail party because they're very slender and pose quite beautifully in the landscape.
Tom, Sandra's already mentioned there how old. Again, we're talking about 3000 BC.
Yeah, this is probably just a bit older than the Ring of Brodgar. Mm-hmm. So you're probably looking at a century or
600 years before the Ring of Brodgar.
Yeah. Doing the path from here is the Neolithic village of Barnhouse, which was the home of the people who would have built this as well. So Barnhouse was the first one to give you the impression that people were living among the monuments rather than the monuments were completely separate, isolated, you know, in an area to itself, a sacred area. There was people living among it.
Sandra, the significance of the site, I mean, what might this have been used for?
Well, could be anything, really. I think we found lots of evidence for food being consumed here. So maybe a place where communities come together to celebrate special events, to mark these kind of transition points in the year and the transition points in our lives. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what was going on here.
It certainly was obviously something very special. I mean, the trouble that they must have taken to erect some of these stones.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, it's all about the investment of time and effort, and as the first of the farming people, you know, they're taking time away from looking after their animals, growing their crops, and investing that time in creating something like this. So while we might not know what it's for, it's clear it was really important to these early people.
Have we any idea, Tom, how these stones were erected?
Well, there's lots and lots of theories, but there was a television programme done, I was going to say recently, but I realised it was 10 years ago, where they were trying to move stones. And there was a local guy who was a farmer that said, well, I remember me granddad used to move standing stones for another reason, because they were used as fence posts, as strainer posts. But what he used was seaweed, because if you put a little path of seaweed down and you
pull the stone along it, it goes at quite a speed rather than rollers, which you just can't get a momentum and keep more rollers in front of you, you know. It's, but getting them upright, it would have been a lot of effort.
Any idea how it might have been done?
Well, you would have had to have the hole dug in advance, and maybe a ramp of sloping earth to you know, haul your stone onto. I know A-frames have been suggested as a way of putting more leverage on a stone to lift it.
Sandra, the Odin stone pierced with a circular hole.
It sat in the field just across there.
And the significance of the hole in it, what?
Well, there's lots of legends associated with it. Certainly, you know, it was believed it had, you know, special properties. If you had a sore neck, sore shoulder, something like that, you would pass the area through the hole in the Odin stone. Newborn babies would be taken up the hill behind us to Big Swell. There's a big well up there. It is said they would bathe in the well and then taken back down and passed through the hole in the Odin stone. Mm. It said it would ensure a long life and they would be free from the palsy. But most importantly, it was a place where young couples came to get married, to do their own lay marriage.
So, yeah, kind of hands through it. Or
sort of hand fasting, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good. Tom, in the early 19th century, a landowner who had recently come to live here decided to remove the stones.
Yeah, Captain William Mackay of infamous fame. He started to destroy the stones. I mean, he was showing Walter Scott around here in August 1814. And then in December 1814, he started to destroy not only the Odin stone, but the stone circle as well. There was a court order was sent against him to stop him from doing any more damage. But by that time, he had pulled down the Odin stone with all that amazing folklore with it and had destroyed it, had smashed it up for building material. He had pulled down two stones in the circle, the one that would have stood next to the one that we're standing under and the one that we are standing under. So these were pulled down, and the other one was broken up and used for stone. And you can still see the marks of the auger that he used to drill into the stone. It's plugged up with cement, but you can see the circular hole there. Yeah. And there is also one above us there as well. And that was to pack full of gunpowder and blow up the stone in order to break it to get building material. So fortunately, he was stopped from doing any more, because he would have taken the rest of them as well. And then it lay there for a long time, till 1907, and it was re-erected then. But the Odin stone, sadly, gone. Yeah. And as a folklorist, it's one of the most significant sites in Orkney, if not the most significant site. There's a wee story connected with it that we had a pirate. Well, we had a couple, actually, but we had a pirate called John Gow. And the problem with Gow was that he wasn't a very good pirate. Kept raiding ships and finding it was carrying stockfish or dried cod, you know. Not the stuff of legend. But he came up to back to Orkney, where he was. Well, he wasn't born here. He was actually born in Wick, in Caithness. But he came to Stromness when he was a kid, about 18 months or so, they reckon. And he came back at the hit with as captain of a ship. And they went, wow, this is really impressive. A young guy in his 20s, and he's made good. But he hadn't. He'd actually murdered the owner of the ship and the first mate and the surgeon. And then took over the ship as a pirate, and he came back to Orkney to try to get some repair work done on it. But while he was here, he sneaked off to the Odin stone with Helen Gordon, who was a girl who was probably a neighbour of him, his in Stromness, and they held hands through the Odin stone and they plighted their troth. When he was captured, when the truth got out as to who he was or what he was hanged in London that June. Twice, in fact, because he dangled for a while and Han died, so they pulled his legs to break his neck, but the rope broke, so they had to rehang him. But the legend goes that, you see, that the binding on the Odin stone, swearing the Odin oath, was so binding that you couldn't marry anyone else until you went through a ritual to break it. But unfortunately, if the person that you wanted to break off with was dead, you know, and there was nobody there, then you couldn't marry again. Mm-hmm. So the legend here has it that she went to London to hold the dead hand that she held in life. Because by that time, he was tarred and hung in chains as a warning to any other would-be pirates. And she went and held his hand, the dead hand that she held in life, and renounced the oath. There is a version, though, in Caithness, which is where he was born, which is where she just got somebody to cut his hand off and post it to her. She renounced the oath and then, like, tossed the hand at the dog or whatever, you know, whatever you do with a spare boyfriend's hand.
The monuments are very much loved and respected here. I think the people of Orkney are always really comfortable with the past. You know, it's all around them, and they're interested in their past.
And the fact that, you know, as far back as 1814, when the damage took place here, that the people did object to it, and, you know, I mean, lots of other places and lots of other situations, the material was used for road building and used for ditch building and all sorts of things.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, I mean, they used it as buyer, a building stone for a buyer, but the local folk did try to burn his house down. So I think that does kind of suggest a certain amount of critical thought.
You know? Is that what you call it? Yeah. Fantastic, fantastic. We're going to leave Sandra again for a while, but we will be talking to her a little later. So thanks for this. And Tom is staying with me to guide me on to other places. And now to play us out to a break in the 10 o'clock news, the Orkney, West Midlands, Strathspey and Real Society with some of their flavours of Orkney.
Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by the new family fish box at Quinlan's Seafood Bars. Packed with golden fish goujons, fresh squid, delicious prawns and tasty homemade chips. Order yours to take away today.
Welcome back. After 51 years in our return to Orkney, 16 kilometres off the north coast of Scotland, on our honeymoon here in 1975, Siobhan and I cycled everywhere, stayed in a B&B. Today's programme was recorded on June the 1st and 3rd. For later programmes, your comment and stories, write Frank Lewis, Mangerton Road, Muckross, Killarney. Email franklewismangerton@gmail.com. Text 083 300 3300 or telephone 066 712 3666. Our druid on Orkney, Tom Muir of orkneyology.com. We're now outside the magnificently shining red sandstone St. Magnus's, the oldest cathedral in Scotland, founded in 1137, uniquely presented to the people of Kirkwall by King James III of Scotland in 1486. Joining us at short notice, Fran Hollenrake, curator at St. Magnus's. Fran, Magnus Erlandsson, Earl of Orkney, early 1100s, shared the earldom with his cousin Hakon, but the two men disagreed.
The story is told that traditionally Hakon had a lot more of the characteristics of his Viking forefathers, that he was a bit more interested in fighting and raiding and travelling and, you know, more warlike in general. Mm-hmm. Whereas Magnus had been educated by monks, you know. And when he was a young man, they had done some raiding together. You know, he wasn't completely, you know, out of that
Still
world.
High, yeah.
Exactly. But as he grew older, he became a lot more interested in a more thoughtful life. More peaceable. He liked praying and reading and talking, and the governance of Orkney just fell apart because they could not agree on how the islands should be ruled. Mm-hmm. So the bishop at the time, Bishop William, had control of one of the little islands, Eggleston, and he said, listen, Magnus, hearken, come to my little island and we'll talk it through. There were rules that they abided by, that they would have the same number of ships and they would have the same number of men. But Magnus was betrayed. He arrived on Eggleston with the agreed number of men and ships, but hearken had many more ships, many more men, weapons, and it was clear from the start that things were not going to go well for Magnus. Mm. And I think Magnus realised that his days were numbered. And he actually agreed to do a deal with Hakon, you know, that he would either be exiled from Orkney and never come back, that he would go off on a permanent pilgrimage. He said, throw me in prison and never let me out, or maim me some way. I think the thinking behind that was that he wanted to save Harkon's soul from the stain of murder, effectively. Mm-hmm. And Hakon was kind of minded to agree to this, but Harkon's followers were not having it. They said, no, one of you's coming out of this alive. And so Magnus was condemned to death as a traitor.
But Magnus was not killed by Hakon himself.
The one person that he could bully into doing it, ordered to do it, was the cook, Leifulf. And he was crying. You know, the saga tells us he was tears in his eyes, and Magnus said to him, Leifulf, it's not your fault. You know, you're just doing what you're told, and I'm praying to God that he forgives you, and I pray for your soul. He asks Leifulf not to strike the blow to the back of his neck, mm-hmm. not like a common thief, strike the blow to the front of my head. And some people refer to Magnus as a martyr, but he didn't die for his faith. But here what he's doing is he's commending his soul to God. He's following God's plan. If this is what God's intent, who am I to argue? Mm-hmm. So in that respect, he is a martyr. He's giving himself into the Christian story. But on the other hand, you don't get much more Viking than an axe to your head. Leifulf striking the blow and felling Magnus as he prays.
You have in the little leaflet on the church here, you have an image of a skull. Is that the skull of Magnus?
I'd say there's a very good chance that it is the skull of Magnus, because we have this key text, the Orkneyinga Saga, which tells us that it was a blow to the head, and the skull has a very distinctive wound in it that would certainly have caused somebody's death. Not only that, that skull was found in a particular part of the choir that would have been feet away from where Magnus's shrine would have been in the Middle Ages, so it's in the most spiritual, most holy part of the cathedral. And we've also, you know, we have so much circumstantial evidence with the text, and then the skull itself with the hole, and then the positioning of where it was found in 1919. I'd say there's a very good chance it's Magnus. And at the time that it was found, in the early 20th century, a professor of anatomy at Aberdeen University examined the bones and came to a number of conclusions and was very happy at the end of it to say, I believe these are the bones of St. Magnus.
Tom, I mean, one of the things we hear is that after he was buried initially up at Bursey, and stories of miracles at his grave started to happen.
Yeah, there is a piece of text, you know, in the Orkneyinga Saga that says that that people started to go and pray at the grave at Christkirk in Bursey, which was built by his grandfather, and that there was lights seen above his grave, and there was sweet perfume smelt, and people started to pray for to recover from illnesses. A lot of them as well was like problems with sight, so blindness also, they would regain their sight.
Nevjur Ragnvald came from Norway to claim the earldom with a promise that he would build this great stone minster in honour of Magnus and create a place of pilgrimage. And Saint Magnus's Way, came across a little information plaque in Finston this morning. That's actually in place.
Yes, and the St. Magnus Way pilgrimage route is a relatively new interpretation of Magnus's story. Back in the Middle Ages, this was a site of pilgrimage. With the coming of the Scottish Reformation in 1560, all of that was swept away.
Tom, a 14th century tower supported by four expanded pillars, each with a sturdy metal ring.
Well, the story is that we do know that during the Commonwealth, when King Charles I was executed and Oliver Cromwell had taken control, that he had billeted troops in Orkney and they had used the cathedral as a stable, because it was always good to show up these Catholic sites as being of inferior use, you know, like making a point that this is only fit for stabling animals.
Yeah. The brass bell from the Royal Oak is here in the cathedral.
It is, yes. It forms the centrepiece of a memorial that we have inside the cathedral.
You have a Sheila Ní Gigh in the 13th century chapel here.
She's got her hand up towards her head and her mouth's open. And this is just my personal view on it. I think she's laughing. She's got such an expression on her face. And the positioning of her in the cathedral, she's directly facing where the two shrines would have been of Magnus and Ronald when they were moved to the East End, where the high altar would have been, surrounded by male clergy. It's such a male cathedral. It's so masculine. She's definitely pointing towards the two shrines and the high altar where all those men are going to be. And to me, what she's saying is, you know, don't forget about me, boys. Don't forget about me. If it wasn't for me, none of you would be here. Marwick's Hole. This is an interesting one. There have been stories told about Marwick's Hole for a long time, about how it was a dungeon, about how it was a holding cell for witches. We think that after the Reformation in 1560, that it became the place where the church session, the Kirk session, used to put people that they feel needed to be punished for crimes against God. So this might be blasphemy, it might be adultery, it might possibly be witchcraft, although there's very few actual contemporary sources for witches being held in there. And unpleasant though it wasn't the punishment. People would be there maybe a couple of days and then they would be taken out and punished. There were certainly witchcraft trials in Orkney. We cannot deny that. There are records of those trials. There were absolute horrors of people being convicted and being executed for witchcraft. But there were other options for holding them as well.
You have 120,000 visitors a year now visiting the cathedral. There's no charge to go into the cathedral.
No, in fact, since that, I would update that number to somewhere north of 200,000 visitors regularly every year now.
Sure.
Yeah.
I should ask you, I mean, we've just come from walking the 7-day St. Brendan's pilgrimage in Kerry. I mean, is there any St. Brendan connection?
I'm not sure there is. I think there are records of St. Brendan being in Scotland. Whether he ever came to Orkney or not, I'm not sure. Don't think there are any church dedications of him here that I know of, but you never know.
Fran, thanks for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals. Available in-store.
In our return to Orkney 51 years after Siobhan and I spent our honeymoon here in 1975, comments for later programmes, text 083 300 3300, phone 066 712 3666. We're talking about Maesau, but we're not actually there because of various reasons. But the chamber cairn, guided again by Tom Muir, and now joined again by Sandra Miller. Sandra, what have we got here at Maesau?
So, one of the most magnificent tombs that you can imagine. The tomb here at Maesau is remarkable. The architecture inside is stunning, but it's famous, probably most famous, for the fact that it aligns to the setting sun during the winter solstice.
So the same as Newgrange?
Very like Newgrange. Newgrange, it's just one day. Here in Orkney, in the north, we know that it's not always a sunny day. So we're looking at a kind of 6-week period. Mm-hmm. There's no great evidence of burial, but given the type of architecture, I think we can deduce that more than likely it may have been used for a burial.
I mean, it's midwinter, so it's the darkest period, you know. And I always had this kind of theory myself that it was almost like the tomb was being used for the sun. You know, the sun was shining into the tomb. It's almost like it was a tomb for the sun as well, and which would then be reborn. A really significant site, because that isn't just a coincidence.
Yeah.
They have to plan that while they're building it. So the first thing that they would have to build, really, is the passageway to get that right. Because, as Sandra said, it's kind of 3 weeks either side of
or the shortest day.
As we were saying at Stennis, Sandra, I mean, again, the Maze Howe fell into disuse during the Bronze Age, 3,300 BC to 1200 BC, but it was again reopened in the AD periods, the 9th to the 12th centuries.
Yeah, the Vikings have been in there. We often say that here in Orkney we have two big periods in our history that kind of really impacted on our islands, the Neolithic period and the Viking period. And of course the Vikings did indeed break into the tomb. I shouldn't have called them Vikings, really. They were Norsemen, you know. Paints a kind of bad picture of them.
And what do we know what they were using it for? Yeah,
so, well, they used it for shelter during a snowstorm, and across the walls in the tomb we have the largest collection of runic inscription on stone outside Scandinavia. It really is a remarkable collection. So Maze Howe offers you two different experiences: the Neolithic tomb, but also this great collection of runes inside.
And again, the runic, it is possible to tell what they were saying.
Absolutely. Some of it is a little perhaps near the edge, you know, there's a bit of bragging, you know, things like that, and a little insults and things. So, but I think Maze Howe is probably most famous for what we call the Maze Howe dragon, this creature that's carved on the wall.
The dragon is just beautiful. You know, it's a stunning little piece. And when you think you're going to be carving that with a knife or whatever you had with you, you know, some sharp instrument, you know, but you could still really, really screw up carving something into stone, you know. But it's beautiful, it's flawless. I mean, it's a really lovely carving. There are also tree runes there as well, which are cryptic runes. So again, the person was showing off their skill, their knowledge of runes, which was more than just letters in an alphabet. I mean, it was also used in magic and such like, and in curses and everything. So runes were really a really important thing.
There must be four. I mean, again, you were saying when we were looking at Maze Howe, the fact that it was in 1860, I think you were saying it.
1861, yeah.
So there must be lots of folklore. There must be lots of mythology associated.
Well, when James Farrar was conducting that excavation, he was warned by the local people that he shouldn't disturb the mound because it was the home of the hog boy who possessed great strength. And this is from an old Viking or an old Norse word, either hog boy or haug bondi. But it both translates as mound dweller. The person that lives in the mound. So it's the spirit of probably the person that broke the land out, but a hogbone was a guardian spirit of a place, looked after the farm. But there was a little story actually about a man from Stennis who was passing Maze Howe one night, and he was wondering what time it was because he was getting a bit worried because he thought it must be getting near midnight, and he didn't want to be in the area at midnight because it's, you know, fairy mound kind of thing. So he looked at his watch, and to his horror he discovered it was just on midnight. And he heard laughter coming from the mound at Maze Howe, and the next thing he knew he found himself being picked up and carried through the air at great speed. And he whizzed through the air, and the next thing he knew, he was dropped down in front of St. Magnus Cathedral in Kirkwall. And when he looked at the clock up there, he seen it was just a couple of minutes past midnight. So he'd been transported all those miles in just a couple of minutes. So you can't mess around with these fairy folk, you know. You
definitely can't.
No, these trolls.
Sandra, I mean, there have been so many key findings in Orkney in recent years. I mean, the Bronze Age gold, the Iron Age investigations, the Pictic symbol stones. Yeah. There's a constant discovering of
further. Yeah, the thing about Orkney is whatever period in history you're interested in, we've got something to offer you. You know, and I think, you know, well, there's small island right on the north coast of Scotland. Probably a lot of folk don't give us a second thought. We're kind of inconsequential. But in actual fact, this has always been a crossroads. A crossroads for people coming from the north and travelling from the south. So Orkney's a special place in the past, but it's a special place today.
Gosh. I mean, that Bronze Age gold, it goes a way back.
Oh, the Naois Na Trotty?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it's beautiful gold. They do say, I think it's the gold comes from possibly, you know, the southern Scotland, but the design of these little button covers possibly is Irish, and it kind of reminds us that these people are travelling and travelling great distances and sharing not just their material culture but their actual culture itself. You know, it's no coincidence that the tomb at Maeshow and the tomb at Newgrange both reflect the sun at the winter solstice.
The advances in technology in recent years have made a huge difference here, haven't they? I mean, again, you were talking earlier about the Ness of Broger. I mean, the whole discovery there depended on technology.
Yes. Orkney's always been quite an innovative place. Contrary to popular belief, Arcadians are quite outward-looking folk. They're great travellers. They're interested in the world. I know historically in the past they used to say that Orkney's great export was professors, because at one point there was an Arcadian professor in all the major universities.
Yeah.
But we look outwards. We're a living community. We embrace new technology and new ideas, and it's a really positive feeling about our island still today.
The whole, I suppose, increased sophistication in relation to pollen analysis and all of these things has hugely changed in recent years as well.
And it's like witchcraft or voodoo these days. I mean, when I first started digging when I was 17, the most advanced piece of equipment that we had on site was a level, and the next most advanced piece of technology was a wheelbarrow, and that was it. And now there's things there that's just straight out of science fiction.
Yeah.
You know, there's a thing that you can fix up to a laptop. It's like a barcode reader, but it analyses the chemical compound in the soil or in stone. So around the hearth, it can say, there's fatty acids found here, so this is where there was dairy products being used or, you know, being made or whatever. Mm. It's mind-blowing. But, I mean, pollen analysis as well has given us an idea of what the landscape was like, because it was, and it's a very different one from what we assumed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, much more trees and... So it's technology and archaeology go hand in hand,
mm-hmm.
and it has changed the way that we perceive the past.
And Sandra, the other thing I suppose that has hugely changed everything here, and it continues to change things on a constant basis, is the whole coastal erosion and the necessary rescue archaeology that follows from that.
Yeah, one of the things about a lot of the archaeology in Orkney is it's actually often discovered because of coastal erosion. And we're very fortunate that we have a really good archaeology department at Orkney College, you know, that will come out and look at things. But as I said, you know, Arcadians are really interested in the past, so people kind of know what they're looking at when you go to an archaeological site. In so many places, you have to explain everything, whereas here in Orkney, Arcadians are quite comfortable to bandy around words like geophysics and pollen analysis and things like that. And that's the delight of Orkney.
There's an old saying here that if you scratch Orkney, it bleeds archaeology. And it's so true.
Fantastic, fantastic. Sandra, you're fantastic. I mean, thanks a million. You've rescued us in ways than one without our being eroded.
Oh, surely not.
Thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer-ready meals available.
Back in Orkney after 51 years, Siobhan and I honeymooned here in 1975. We're looking in the past half century how it was found Orkney was a leader in Britain and much of Europe. 5,000 years ago, the impact of oil, learning more about the past. And today and tomorrow, guided by Tom Muir, who has been looking after us so well during this tour. We're also joined by Mark Harkus, the editor of The Arcadian, the weekly newspaper. In fact, now, looking at your front page, Mark, of this past edition, this past week, you have been selected as the best weekly in Scotland.
Yes, it was an excellent accolade to receive.
Orkney, the world capital of renewals.
The renewable sector in Orkney has become internationally renowned for the kind of world-leading technology and the international companies that have based themselves here have tested their devices, ranging from wave and tidal energy devices. You've got a turbine. You take a look through the landscape of Orkney, and you'll be hard pressed to find one kind of panoramic view that doesn't include a wind turbine, whether that's a large one or a kind of small scale one on somebody's private land. You've got electric vehicles, as you say. The take up. I mean, one particular study a few years ago now showed that we were producing more than 100% of our power just purely through wind.
Just wind alone?
Wind alone. Yeah. More than 50 years on from the opening of the Flot Oil Terminal, we have now got the most significant infrastructure project that has taken place, which is the building of a new substation. Electrical substation here in Orkney, which will then connect Orkney to for the first time to the national grid.
Can this replace the clearly the oil industry is less important than it was? It was hugely important. I mean, you were 400,000 barrels of crude a day being taken at the station here.
Yeah, I mean the terminal obviously went through a period of transition maybe a year or two ago, just to make it as cost effective as they could. I wouldn't want to say whether you could say a purely net zero future is on the horizon anytime soon.
Tom, the fishing and farming were the farmers' staples, I suppose, here. There were the economies all over the years. How are they doing now?
Fishing is still important, but it's certainly nothing like it used to be in the past. Mm. It was an industry, you know, it was in decline for a long time. Farming, though, is still very important.
Land is very fertile here. I mean, the fields are green and large, and there are great herds of black and orange or brown cattle, and lots of sheep.
Mm-hmm. More cattle than sheep.
Mark, I was looking yesterday in the museum, the exhibition on a recent arrival, the stoat. Causing huge harm, and again a very ambitious scheme to get rid of them.
Yeah, I think that scheme was first announced, I want to say 2014. It was a £8 million project when it was first announced to carry out a full eradication of the invasive stoat, which is a non-native predator here. Cause you get a serious threat to Orkney's kind of world-renowned wildlife.
I mean, numbers are in decline. I mean, when I was a bairn, there's a hell of a lot, you know, fewer birds now than there was when I was young. You know, I mean, it has gone down. They're holding their own at the moment.
Mark, how important is tourism here?
Very, very.
There clearly is a shortage of accommodation, though, and access is difficult and expensive, and food is of varying standards.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. You've got your kind of long-stay tourists that'll maybe spend a week here on the islands. And then you've got the cruise liner industry, which is huge. Orkney is now the largest UK port for cruise liners. I think there's 208 scheduled for this year.
Four a week.
Yeah, it used to be that you'd maybe think, again, maybe May, June, July, August, and then the kind of season was tailing off. Now you're speaking about almost a kind of 9 or 10 month season.
In fact, one of the things, Tom, that we saw was that all of the World Heritage sites, and I'm sure lots of the other sites, are open all year. And in fact, the leading World Heritage sites are staffed all the time. So that, I mean, hotels are doing business 12 months of the year, the restaurants are doing business 12 months of the year, because you don't get the extremes of temperature that one might have thought you would have got this far north.
Yeah, no, I mean, the climate has changed in my lifetime. You know, it was warmer in the summers and colder and more frost and snow in winter, whereas there's much of a muchness now, you know. Mm. The one other thing, which is a main, can't call it industry, but a main attraction for tourism, is the heritage of the islands. That is what brings people here. It's the ancient history, from the Neolithic, you know, the monuments that we've visited already, to places like, you know, St. Magnus Cathedral. So you've got that whole Viking, Nordic, you know, medieval Norse period. And people come to see that. And of course, the other thing, very importantly, is the wartime sites as well.
And in your current edition as well, Mark, I mean, you had five pages on the Orkney Folk Festival, which is obviously a major event.
Yes, the Folk Festival. I mean, I think, actually, Orkney, there was a study done a few years ago, and I think it has, per capita and per head, it's got the most festivals in all of the UK.
One of the things that surprised us, I mean, the other day we happened to bump into St. Magnus's, and there was a concert on there last Saturday, and we were surprised at how similar the music was to traditional Irish music.
When I was a kid, nobody played the fiddle, you know.
Oh, yeah? So that's a revival?
Yeah, absolutely. It's through the school, and people like Douglas Montgomery, who's done a tremendous amount, and the Wrigley sisters as well, with teaching kids fiddle playing in schools and afterwards in their own time.
One of the stories, Mark, that my neighbours on Mangerton will relate to, on your page 16 last week, suspected dog attack, very worrying.
It can be devastating for a farmer. It really can be. I mean, that's their pride and joy. That's their livelihood. There's been a huge amount of work to try and, you can, just to remind people of their responsibilities as pet owners, round about livestock, particularly round about calving and lambing times, to keep your animal on a lead. I mean, we live in a place that where farming is a staple of the economy here. You're never too far away from livestock and fields, so it really is. I mean, it should just go without saying that you should be keeping your dogs on the lead.
Yeah, Tom, I was surprised to read that 30% of Arcadians work in the public sector.
That's a lot of people work for the council. Yeah,
so a third of all the jobs. The other thing that surprised me, Mark, was that the library. I know our own libraries, again, are widening their services all the time, but here the library has a cycle repair kits and repair stands as well.
Yes, yeah. Our award-winning library, which I think it's not lost on people when you see councils ever increasing budgets, that they're pretty much your swimming pools and your libraries are the first ones to close. But luckily we have such a fantastic library and archive centre here. And as you say, it's not just books or whatever, it's like bike repairs now.
I had a pair of walking sticks that I got from the library.
Even better, yeah. And they do they have fancy dress stuff for bairns and different other things. They've got a fantastic children's area. They've got Lego building there. It is just such a fantastic facility there.
What are the big differences? I mean, normally a local authority would have limited range of services, but here in Orkney, you have all the necessities of life. You have hospitals, schools, cafes, you have churches, you have shops, you have bars, obviously. You have the library, you have a museum, you have a theatre, you have a cinema, swimming pools, sports pitches. More facilities, I suspect, than many places in Britain or in Ireland.
We're fairly self-sustainable in that sense. I mean, last year we welcomed over 2,000 athletes from across the world, from 24 other islands, as part of the International Island Games, the biggest event that's ever been hosted here in Orkney. It was a multi-sport event over, I think it was 12 sports, and then over 6 days, held in the smallest island ever to host it.
Mark, thanks indeed for talking to us.
No problem. Thank you.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan's.
Today, a trip we were to take a year ago to Orkney Island, where Siobhan and I honeymooned 51 years ago. We're at Scarabray. My guide the whole way around is historian, author and storyteller Tom Muir. And here at Scarabray, we're joined by visitor experience supervisor Gianluca Mazzagari.
Scarabray, it's a Neolithic village, was founded roughly around 3100 BC. It consists of 10 structures, 9 are houses, while 1 is the so-called workshop. So the houses, they have a similar disposition of furniture inside. structure 18 set was found with a lot of pottery, a lot of knives.
Mm-hmm. And the 10 houses are joined together by a series of tunnels.
So people would not have had to stand outside in the elements when moving from one part to the other of the village.
And it's built into a, or partly built into a midden, a dump site.
It would have also generated heat, which was, of course, a brilliant strategy for these people to also, you know, sort of get the village warmer.
This place was unknown up to 1850 in modern times. What happened then?
So in 1850, there was a storm that sort of damaged part of the coastline here. And, well, the family that lived in Scale House, especially William Watt, after the storm, came to check the damages caused in his land. And at some point, stumbling on one of the so-believed sand dunes, he found that there was a collapsed wall sticking out. Now, the collapsed wall was actually the one that we can sort of see here from structure one. That basically just got out of the sand dune, and he, seeing this wall and not realizing that there was any, or at least not believing that there was any structure that started the earliest excavation in the 1860s. So he uncovered part of the village.
Tom, what makes this a World Heritage Site?
Well, look at it. I mean, they're talking about furniture there, and people are probably thinking, you know, sort of IKEA or something, but this, all the furnishings here are made of stone, which is why they are preserved. You've got stone beds, you have the central hearth, and you have the, well, what is known as a dresser at the one end, which has been argued as for storage. When it was first uncovered, they thought of it as an altar. And now they're going back to the thought of it being an altar again after the excavations at Nessa Brodgar. But that's the first thing you see as you crawl through the low doorway, is that stone dresser standing in front of you. So you may have had, you know, important things there on display, or maybe it was used for rituals. Who knows?
Why is everything built of stone?
Well, that is a good question. In the past, they would say, well, it was the material that they had. They didn't have much trees. But they actually did have trees. But there is a period from the early Neolithic, when they first started farming here, about, you know, 5,500 plus years ago, they were building in wood, but then, and they built tombs in stone, but then for some reason there was a change where they started to adopt building in stone like the tombs. So they always say that the tombs were like the houses of the dead, but actually the houses are like the tombs of the living, you know. So it's a strange one. But, I mean, the stone here does lend itself to it because it's sedimentary rock from a lake bed, so it splits evenly, makes really good building material.
They were very sophisticated people all 5,000 years ago, weren't they? I mean,
yes, indeed, yeah.
But it had a later period. I mean, it was abandoned for this long period, and then...
So there was, there is sort of uncertain whether it was actually sort of completely abandoned, but we definitely do see this sort of secondary period that is the one that's mostly characterizing the site nowadays. Now, this period happened around after 2800 BC, and we see a more planned out village, let's say, like all the houses are linked together. Interestingly enough, actually, we do have also drains, so characterizing the village that, of course, a lot of people do not tend to link to Neolithic activity, but actually we do have some drains here under some of the structures.
Tom, I mean, you have spent a lot of your life collecting folklore and working in folklore in the museum and so on. Is there a particular story from the folklore connected with Scarabray that comes to mind?
Not with Scarabray, because remember, nobody knew it was here.
Indeed.
But the Bay of Scale, where we are, was a hotbed for the Finn folk, who were a race of people that lived under the sea. And the Finn king was actually killed just at the end of the bay, but they took a fancy to meal, to, you know, barley, ground barley flour, and took a liking for bread. So they used to raid a small mill that was here. Not maybe the giant, you know, Victorian one, but a smaller one on the site, until the miller ended up giving up and moving away. But there was an old woman said that she could help, and she went in there with a pot and some fire and water and some kale to boil on a ladle and a spinning wheel, and she started spinning and she was boiling the water. And the Finn folk, seeing a light on, came up to raid the place. And the one went in and sat next to her and looked at what she was doing and said, "Who are you? You know, what's your name?" And she said, "My name is Sel in the Mill." So it's like myself in the mill. Yeah. And she took up a big ladle full of boiling water and kale and threw it over his legs and burnt him. And he screamed and ran out. And when the other one said, "What happened to you? You know, who did this?" He said, "I'm badly burnt." And they said, "Who did it?" "It was Sel in the Mill." Yeah. And they went, "Well, if Sel did it, Sel can sail away in the waters with it." And they left and never came back. So they left a wee basket for her that could hold about a meal, about the flour, so that the old woman never had to go hungry again.
There is, isn't there, Jane? Look, there was a period when the Vikings also, after what, hundreds, thousands of years, when the whole area hadn't been used, and they came and lived here.
Yes, indeed. Actually, the name from Scale perhaps reminds the sort of like it's a toponym that is usually used when there is like a drinking hole or a Viking long hole. Now, in this case specifically, they actually found a long hole on the shore of this bay. The site of Scarabra itself perhaps would not have been, as we were saying, would not have been known at that time.
Tom, there are elaborate carvings found on some of the stones in the houses and passages here. Mm. Are they telling us anything, or do we know?
Well, it's an interesting question. Usually carvings was found in relations to tombs, not in domestic settings. But there were ones here. And then when I started excavating Nessa Brodgar, I mean, there are, you know, I don't know what the figure stands at now. I mean, it's a couple of thousand or so. These, they're carvings, but they're not like pictures. They're sort of geometrical patterns. And,
so they're not like Ogham or something.
Don't know.
Yeah.
But it's probably... It would have, I mean, it's got a significance, it's got a meaning. Mm. Like at Brodgar, they have this Brodgar butterfly, which is sort of two triangles that with the points touching. Mm. So it looks like the kind of wings of a butterfly, but, I mean, you know, what exactly the meanings of them are, I couldn't say.
Indeed. Jane, look, this whole area has been very thoroughly excavated and conserved. Are there any particularly interesting findings in the excavations?
Well, yes, one of the most emblematic, let's say, will be the carved stone bowl. So those are sort of decorated, usually bowl-shaped stone objects that we still don't
They're
really...
They're like kind of tennis ball size? Or...
Yes, indeed. There are some slightly bigger or anything like this, but some that are not exactly bowl-shaped, but they are quite emblematic, quite interesting and baffling, let's say, because we don't really know exactly what they might be used for. They don't have any sort of practical use.
So you don't know whether it was an early form of a shinty or hurling, as it would have been in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. Let's say that to her such an object would have required a lot of time to create, so we don't really think it would have used, for example, for either as a form of weapon or for hunting or anything like that.
What about road bowling? There were no roads, of course, but...
I mean, that could be a very interesting hypothesis. Yeah. Unfortunately, sort of, for this, any guess is sort of as likely.
Have you a theory on that, Tom?
Well, obviously, they're ritualistic objects that had great significance because, I mean, they did take a very long time to make. I mean, the stone, they always use hard stones, igneous rock, and then it's got to be ground into the shape and then polished. I mean, you know, you're looking at a lot of man hours to make one of those.
Indeed. But do you know anything, Jane Looker, about the diet?
We have found charred remains of plants, especially near the heart, indeed. Those would have been naked barley, whole barley in minor quantities, and chiefly also wheat, which is something that today we can't grow on the island. Because of that, we believe that there would have been a slightly warmer temperature and perhaps the weather would have been rather different from what it is today.
Tom, I suppose one of the things about it, I mean, there's nothing else like it in Western Europe, is there?
There are other sites like this in Orkney, but...
Of course.
But not anywhere else. Yeah. yeah. which is predominantly using wood to build with. So, I mean, the fact that they started using stone did mean that these things are amazingly preserved. And you can actually go into, you know, well, you can't actually go into the houses now. They used to when you were here on honeymoon, but...
indeed, yeah.
But, I mean, you could... You know, you can look down into a Neolithic house, which is something that not many people have the privilege of doing.
It's hugely interesting. Thanks indeed for talking to us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
After 51 years, our return visit to Orkney. Thanks to Siobhan for 51 years of loving and helping in so many ways. On today's programme, special thanks to Tom Muir, who... share more of Orkney's hidden delights through orkneyology.com, a joint venture with his wife Rhonda, Tom's invaluable help over three long days, and Sandra Miller covered three sites with us, and all of those who talked with me. Location sound and programme coordinator, my fellow Orkney visitor in 1975, and again now, and my mainstay for all of the years in between, Siobhan Lewis. Post-production on today's programme, the ever-patient and professional Alan O'Brien. To sum Orkney up, the amazing antiquity, sites open all year, no access problems to cliff or coast or site. Walking the cliffs, the bird life, the fields full of sea pink, the thrift, or the blue purpley spring squill. Friendliness, everybody salutes, endlessly helpful. It's expensive, access, accommodation, food, but it's worth it. For me, Frank Lewis, until the last Saturday in July the 25th, when we'll travel again in our amazing world, near or far. For these weeks and months, enjoy all of the blessings of summer. Thanks for your company. Pat Kelly will be with you after the news. And now to play us out, the great traditional orchestra we heard in St. Magnus's Cathedral, the Orkney West Midland Stratsby and Real Society and Friends, give us some of their flavours of Orkney.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Because at least one day of the weekend should involve someone else doing all the cooking. Order your delicious takeaway from Quinlan's today.